A man can hardly be a beast or a fool alone on a great mountain. Francis Kilvair. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If this is your first time listening, welcome. We have quite a backlog of episodes for you to join in and listen to. And to any returning listeners, again, thank you again for all your support. This week, we're going to be moving south and east from where we were last week, from the Southern Caucasus. And we're going to be talking about people living in what is now, I guess, northwest and western Iran, the Zagros Mountains, and the southern Caspian coast between 6 and 4,000 BC. BCE, whichever you prefer. Now, as we discussed briefly last time, prior to the start of this season's time period, there was, and continued to be, a large genetic overlap to the hunter-gatherer population in these three or so regions, or sub-regions as the case may be. Now, the peoples of the southern Caspian had other links in addition to their cousins in the Southern Caucasus and the Zagros. They also had ties and maintained them with peoples along the eastern coast of the Caspian and with the cultures of Central Asia. In fact, it is likely that kind of the land route through the Gorgon Plain was a major route through which domesticated sheep and goat herds first entered the region. Pardon for the quick cut there, I had a bit of a coughing fit. And what I essentially meant was sheep and goats entering Asia, or Central Asia, coming from the west. Probably mainly through the Gorgon Plain, at least that's one of the primary routes through which they migrated, or were herded through. Now the Gorgon Plain is a narrow, flat land starting in kind of the northern, I guess the northwest foothills of the Alborz, along the southern curve of the Caspian, and it moves east where it begins to widen out, and it meets the Shahrud Plain, which also flattens out from the, I guess, the eastern Alborz Mountains. And where they combine together, they continue to the north, where they meet the Central Asian Steppe. Now, the Gorgon Plain was and is much more fertile than the steppe, and even the Shahrud Plain, though the Shahrud Plain is more fertile than the steppe as well. But it essentially gets a large amount of rainfall from, like, you know, weather patterns along the Caspian, as well as river and stream water flowing down from the melting snow and ice from the Alborz Mountains. Now, this will allow the region to grow crops, as well as have a number of different fruit orchards. Oranges, grapes are also imported into the region. Wine becomes produced in this area eventually. Now, this region is also home to a massive number of Neolithic sites. There's over 50 that have been found, all of them seeing at least two periods of occupation. Now, that shows that most of these sites are not being used at the same time. Some of them are, some of them aren't, but they are being occupied by mobile either hunter-gatherers or pastoralists, or a mix of the two. And you can kind of see that. Some of these sites date all the way back to the Paleolithic. Though, again, most are kind of traced to the start of this season. But the sites that were used back in the Paleolithic and sites used last season, you know, between the Paleolithic to about 6,500 BC and this season show how much the diet of these peoples have changed. You can see a lot of evidence of how and what type of animals you know, that are being butchered and killed. From the Paleolithic era, you find a lot of seals being killed along the coasts and being eaten. You also see a lot of gazelles, things like that, as well as, I believe, a lot of shellfish. But when you begin to get that transition period between the Neolithic and the Paleolithic, you begin to see less and less gazelle. But there is an upkeep in wild aurochs bones. You don't see as many seals or shellfish. And then by the time you get to this season, almost all of the bones found in like garbage middens are either sheep or goats. So you can see how quickly, when I say quickly, you go from a very long period in that Paleolithic mindset to kind of that transitory period, starting around 8,000 to 6,000. So within 2,000 years, you're almost completely relying on domesticated animals. And that is, again, when you see a large or more sites being occupied at a time. That's why you see the huge uptick starting right around the start of this season in Neolithic sites in this part of the Iranian Plateau, Caspian Sea area. Now, for most of the last 20 years, the general idea was that these sites are heavily connected and influenced to the Jetun culture of Central Asia in what is now primarily Turkmenistan. However, starting around 2016, 2017, there's been a little bit of challenge to this idea. We can definitely see that the Jetun influenced the sites along the Gorgan Plain as well as the Sharud Plain. However, and we can tell this because of the pottery found. It looks like it is very similar, if not identical, to Jetun sites. There is a little bit of work being done challenging that they're all the same people. I think what I was reading most recently, and this isn't the newest study, it's from 2017, but it's Rostai and Nakanda are the authors. It's Neolithic Developments in the Gorgan Plain, southeast of the Caspian Sea. It makes it sound like the Gorgan Plain was kind of its own, not culture, because they did have a lot of similar artifacts, but this may have been a little bit more isolated or a separate group from the Jetun culture. But they had, deep trade links as well as, other types of interactions with the Jetun culture, which probably they still believed that the Jetun culture was influencing or was kind of the progenitor of the Sharud Plain sites. But we're going to talk more about them when we get to Central Asia. So just keep that in mind. It's possible that the Gorgan Plain peoples are the same peoples occupying the Jetun sites. And I believe I mentioned Jetun last season because they did have Jetun itself was, I guess, founded, if you want to say that, kind of in the mid part of last season. But they continue all the way through to the end of this season. But again, we're going to focus more on them when we get to Central Asia. The Gorgan Plain peoples, again, their number of their sites are increasing. The number of sheep and goats that they are in control of is basically replacing all of their hunted food. Now, their gathering is probably very similar to what it had been when they were primarily hunter-gatherers. But in terms of like animal bones, it's a completely domesticated source. So they are no longer hunter-gatherers. They are now nomadic pastoralists. Now, that is also true of their Zagros Mountain cousins. But unlike the Gorgon Plain or the Southern Caspian culture, and like the Southern Caucasus group, they are having to deal with the arrival of agriculture and agriculturalists in much greater numbers. Now, and in fact, as we discussed last season, I mean, that has been happening since the end of last season. Though, as we'll talk about, there wasn't nearly as sharp a decline in artifacts and kind of archaeological remains of the preceding hunter-gatherer pastoralist groups in the Zagros. And there are a few reasons for this, especially compared to like the Southern Caucasus. First, the hunter-gatherers slash pastoralists in the Zagros, of course, had been more eager adopters of herding as a way of life, or at least as a supplement to their gathering and hunting. And this is something, again, that they shared with their cousins along the Southern Caspian. But this meant that even if the wild game and grasses they were used to were no longer available due to, you know, agriculture dispersing or removing them, they had parallel food sources to rely on. In fact, probably the goats, you know, that they were in control of probably preferred the mountains and hills compared to like the flatlands. Now, and the agriculturalists probably would not have cared for that land even if they did control it. They probably would have left it fallow, or, you know, used it as a site to, you know, maybe kind of retreat or relax in, or maybe draw other resources from, like stones. Secondly, the population of the hunter-gatherers or pastoralists, whatever they were, was larger in this area. And this was due not just to them being pastoralists, but the area didn't have nearly as bad of a winter as you would see in the Southern Caucasus. And until the start of our season, it seems to have gotten a lot more rain than it does today. And that's something we talked about when we mentioned possible reasons for the decline of the Northern Mesopotamia material cultures this season. So that means that they're probably weren't as easy to drive off or kill as, say, maybe the Caucasian hunter-gatherers neighboring the Shuleviri Shomu culture were. Now, that's not to say that the agriculturists didn't try or that the nomadic pastoralists didn't lose ground, but it doesn't appear to have been nearly as dramatic of a shift as in the Southern Caucasus. Now, that being said, the cultures practicing agriculture in the Zagros do not have nearly as sharp of a decline as the Shuleviri Shomu culture. Excuse me, the SSC. I got to remember to abbreviate it. It's so much easier to say. In fact, these cultures don't really decline at all. And we'll talk more about them. They're kind of going to be our focus for the last part of this section. But there is a lot of give and take between the pastoralists and the sedentary cultures. And these two groups learn from each other. And in some ways, they kind of develop a somewhat symbiotic relationship. Their relationship is certainly complicated, but they deal with each other much more successfully than, say, some of the other Mesopotamian cultures or other settled agricultural societies deal with their own nomadic pastoralist neighbors. And we'll get more into that, of course, as time goes on. I've hinted at that several times in several episodes. Now, there is a difference between the herders of the Zagros as opposed to the ones along the Southern Caspian coast. They appeared to have more to do with cattle. They, of course, still had plenty of goats and sheep, but it does appear that if cattle were a much larger part of the herding process, among the Zagros pastoralists that you don't see in the Southern Caucasus or along the Caspian Sea, at least not at this season. That changes as time goes on, but cattle were much more important among the Zagros pastoralists. And that's true also of the settled societies of the Zagros Mountains. I believe they had a little bit more cattle compared to the sheep and goats to, say, like the southern Mesopotamians. Or at least they had as many as. Or at least they, maybe that's not the best way to phrase it. I would say they had a slightly higher portion of cattle. At least that's what it appears to be from what I've read. Now, I could be misinterpreting that data, but I don't think so. And this kind of ties in with a couple of other things that we're going to go over. The connection between, or the potential connection between the old Taz Tepler sites and some of the standalone sites in what is now Iran. There is evidence of some overlap between certain aspects of the Taz Tepler sites, like Çatalhöyük, Göbekli Tepe, with some sites in what is now modern Iran. The most famous of these, of course, is Shanidar in like the far northwest of Iran, kind of on the Iran-Iraq-Turkish border, or at least that's the modern area. And Shanidar is, of course, famous for a number of Neanderthal burials that had been found. But it was also, there was a Neolithic site at Shanidar, and then, you know, a couple of times prior to that by Homo sapiens. And this is kind of like right along the kind of the far northeastern edge of the Fertile Crescent. So this is a route by which a lot of early domesticated plants and possibly animals could flow through. And then Shanidar is kind of at that, again, that far northeast. But then as you head to the southeast, as it, that crescent begins to crest downward, you run into several sites that were existing sometimes last season, but some of them last till this season. Jarmo is what is in now modern Iraq, though it's very close to the Iran-Iraq border. That started around 7,500, but it lasts until about 5,000 BC. So it's kind of right that first part of this season. And this is one of the areas where you see the first evidence of domesticated cattle entering Iran. So it's interesting that you see these domesticated crops, at least in small numbers. But then you also see the domesticated animals end up in the hands of groups that are far more mobile than what you would see at Jarmo and at Shanidar. So that is something that's kind of, you can see maybe that there's a kind of a mix. Maybe this is a part where you begin to see groups begin to kind of focus on different lifestyles. I don't know that they've ever done DNA on, or if they found any usable DNA for humans at Jarmo, but I would be very interested to see how close it is to, say, the Caucasian hunter-gatherers versus the something along the lines of the Natufian people, you know, from the Levant, or even someone from, say, Göbekli Tepe. But Jarmo shows clear trade links to a number of different areas. They have obsidian from Lake Van, which is very prestigious in a lot of different areas that we've talked about this season. They also have shells from the Persian Gulf. So they have very long trade links, which, you know, for a settled society of only around 200 people or so, pretty impressive. So I definitely think that they are somehow tied into a much more mobile group. Again, they enter a decline around, I believe it's around 5,800, where the site begins to see less activity. And then right around 5,000 BC, the site is abandoned. This is probably in line, again, with the collapse of some of the cultures that they were trading with, like the Hassuna, the Halaf cultures. Again, this is not an area that is well-watered by rivers, so they were having to rely on rainfall. And this is a period, again, where you see rainfall drop pretty precipitously. And this ties into a couple of other sites we talked about last season, also probably influenced by the Taz Tepler sites and other sites in the Fertile Crescent, Ali Kash, Ganj Dara. These were founded, relatively closely to Jarmo, but they collapsed before Jarmo did. Now, that is not the end of agriculture in this area at 5,000. In fact, just a couple hundred years later, there are several new agricultural societies being built, and they will found cities in this region. And they're going to be the focus of our next episode. But it appears that they kind of, again, are involved with long-range trade, though they are probably controlling the trade, at least to the Mesopotamia and to the south. But like Jarmo and Ganj Dara and Ali Kash, they're probably relying on the pastoralists of the Zagros to get trade going with groups to their north and northeast. We can tell this because wine shows up fairly early in these agricultural settlements. Within, I think, around 200 years of being established. And this is some of the oldest wine in the region. And as far as I know, grapes were not native to the region. So this is something that they are getting from the Southern Caucasus area, which shows you just how fast this stuff can spread if it is deemed as valuable. So that kind of ties in the various groups that are mobile, still living, a more traditional Homo sapien lifestyle, moving fairly regularly. Though, with herds, you don't have to move as often. You can, if you want to, if your neighbors are being a-holes, you can just pack up and leave or, get out of Dodge while they're, really focused and aggressive, and then you can just come back later and hit them when they're not expecting it. Or you can form longer-lasting relationships built on trade and other aspects, which we will talk about next week when we go over the foundations of what will become Elam and Susa. And these are two sites that are kind of on the peripheral of Mesopotamia. We know about them from Mesopotamian sources. They have their own history and culture, and they will last for quite a while. But they will be, in some ways, much more integrated with their more nomadic neighbors than the Mesopotamians would be. And that will, at some points, be a very strong advantage. But that is all for the very far future episodes to talk about. Trying to think if there's... there is some thought that the ancestors of the Kurdish people are in this region already, that they are belonging to the pastoralists of northwestern Iran. Now, the Kurdish people are not a monolith, and they have regional variations. the Kurds in what is now Georgia have a slightly different genetic makeup from, say, Kurds in what is now Iraq. They are not probably any one group, at least in this season. Some of their ancestors are probably in the region, but there are some that will still come in. I think they've done both mtDNA, which follows more of the maternal line, and Y chromosome data, which is more of the male line. And it shows that the Kurdish groups on their, I believe it's their mother's side, are more closely related to European hunter-gatherers than they are to Caucasian hunter-gatherers on their mother's side. But the opposite is true on the male side. And also, they're more closely related to West Asians than Central Asians in the reverse there as well. So there's definitely, you know, the foundations of the Kurdish people, they show up, they think they show up. It's kind of depends on how you interpret some of the Sumerian and Akkadian sources as early as the third millennium, which would be next season. Though, again, that is debated. And they're not the only Iranian people to appear or potentially appear that early. That is something, again, we're going to go over in future. But next week, we'll be back and we'll be talking about, again, the foundations of the Kingdom of Elam as well as Susa. A little bit shorter episode this week compared to last week, but I did want to kind of go over the pastoralists. I feel like I've kind of given them short shrift, talking about the more settled societies. Part of that is just because those societies are, because they're stationary, they are much more likely to leave an imprint on archaeological matters, whereas, you know, mobile pastoralists, you know, they leave a mark, but it's not nearly as easy to interpret. Anyway, I felt like I was giving them short shrift, so I wanted to kind of give them a couple of episodes before focusing again on, you know, the next round of urbanizing societies. But that will probably finish us off for kind of Western Iranian plateaus, Zagros, Caspian Sea area. Then we'll be moving into the Eastern Iranian plateau, Central Asia. Of course, we'll probably move into India, Pakistan area, and then we'll go from there. We will have a regular episode next week. I'm going to try and have the episode out following Christmas at regular time. That might be slightly delayed. But if you have any questions, comments, feedback, constructive criticism, please feel free to reach out to me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on X/Twitter. You can comment on my YouTube videos. You are listening on whatever service, please like, subscribe, download, all that kind of good stuff. Rate. It will, you know, help the channel grow. And it's been a big year, and I think next year is going to be even bigger. Thank you all. I will see everyone next week. I hope you have a good rest of your day/week from wherever you're listening to this. And I will see you all next time. Take care. Peace.